This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The Me Too movement has centered around individual men accused of assaulting or harassing multiple women. But what happens when one woman deals with multiple harassers? Elle Magazine columnist E. Jean Carroll can relate to this. 2 weeks ago, she published an article in New York Magazine listing several of the men who took advantage of her. Her list includes two big names, former TV executive Les Moonves and Donald Trump. More than 20 women have accused President Trump of sexual misconduct, including Ms. Carroll. The president has denied these accusations. What happens after women share their stories? And what happens when the incidents are so numerous that you could almost lose count? As you might expect, this conversation will probably get very intense, especially if you are a survivor of rape or assault. So if you'd like to listen to this later, when you're ready, you'll find it online at the1a.org. Also, if you or someone you know needs help, you can reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Here's the number, 800-656-4673. Again, 800-656-4673. Joining us from NPR in New York is E. Jean Carroll, advice columnist for Elle Magazine and author of What Do We Need Men For? A Modest Proposal. E. Jean, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Joshua. It's delightful to be here.
Also joining us from NPR in New York is Chavisa Woods, the author of 100 Times, A Memoir of Sexism. Chavisa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
E. Jean, let me start with you and give you a chance to tell your story for those of you who didn't read the piece in New York Magazine. Before we get to the piece involving now President Trump, reading the piece was really hard and heartbreaking and infuriating. And I think that was kind of the point, is to show the grinding impact of kind of a lifetime of men just being disgusting and what that does to a person.
Yes, Joshua, you nailed it. It has been, I have run into 21 hideous men. However, my life has been very happy and almost a very merry life. I have not let any of these 21 men get to me. I have kept my chin up. I put it behind me as fast as I can. And I'm finding, Joshua, in the book, you'll see, it's a humorous take on most of the hideous men because, Joshua, if I thought seriously for 30 seconds about all the horrible things, I would be very sad. And when I'm sad, it doubles my burden, right? But when I laugh, Joshua, as women have done for centuries, we laugh at things that are painful. But if I laugh, I feel better about it. I put it behind me and I move on.
Can I ask you specifically about the incident with Mr. Trump? You said that it happened in a dressing room at a department store, Bergdorf Goodman. Did you know Donald Trump before this incident?
I had met him briefly, and this was in the mid-90s. And I want to correct everyone's memories. In the mid-90s, Donald Trump was hailed in New York. We all adored him. He'd walk around the city. He'd be walking around. He was good looking. He would talk to people. He was not totally full of himself. He'd ask you how you were doing. And so I had a little TV show on at the time called Ask E. Jean. So I was going out of Bergdorf's. Donald Trump was going in. He held up his hand and he said, "Hey, you're that advice lady." And I'm like, "Oh, recognize me." I said, "You're that real estate mogul." He said, "Come advise me. I'm buying a present for a girl." Well, I thought it was the most charming thing I'd ever. I just thought, this is just, I can dine out on this story for weeks. It's just going to be terrific. I used to be a writer at Saturday Night Live, so I'm already forming the sketch in my head. So we look at the handbags. He's not interested in the handbags. We go to the hats. He grabs a fur hat. I say, "No woman wants to wear a dead animal on her head." Later, I looked on the internet, and of course, there's a picture of Ivana and Marla Maples meeting in Aspen on the ski slope, both wearing huge fur hats on their head. Anyway, that's so. He, at that point, said lingerie. And like a fool, Joshua, I thought it was an even better idea because it was going to make a better story. We went up to the lingerie department, and there was nobody there. It was in the evening. And he grabbed up a lilac bodysuit, which was on the counter, and snatched it up and said, go put this on. I said, you put it on. He said, no. He held it up against me. He said, it looks like it fits you. I said, it's your color. It matches your eyes. I was laughing. I thought this was very funny. He said, he made a motion towards the dressing room. I thought, this is even better because I'm going to make him put this on over his pants. That was what I was thinking.
And I just want to be clear at this point, Eugene. It sounds like at this point it was very playful, and you didn't feel at all threatened by him thus far.
This is Donald Trump, well known by every single person in the city. If there's one guy I trust, it's Donald Trump. He is like tall, big, handsome, and here I'm going to use a word that we don't associate with him, but jolly. I know. And I admit it was flirtatious. But, you know, when there's a law passed, a woman can't flirt with a man. I mean, why would I leave the house? So
you go into the dressing room.
Well, I preceded him into the dressing room with the idea of making him put this on over his pants. And as soon as he slammed the door behind us and banged me up against the wall, and my head hit, and the fight started. I was so surprised. I was so shocked. He put his lips against mine. I couldn't believe it. My reaction was to start laughing and to try to make a joke about it. And he was dead serious. And that's when it started.
At what point were you able to get away from him?
Very quickly. I'm going to say less than 2 minutes. Because what was going on was it hurt. I fought like a tigress. And it was against my will. And I got out, I'm going to guess, within 2 or 3 minutes and left the store. So it was very violent. And my reaction to it, apparently, my friend told me later because I had called her on the phone, was to laugh. I apparently continued to laugh until I got out, and I was still laughing when I called my friend. She had to say, Eugene, when I started to say, he pulled on my, this is hilarious, guess who I ran into? Apparently, she's had to tell me this later. She said, Eugene, this is not funny. You stop laughing. At that point, I realized I was laughing. So that was my way of dealing with it. And apparently, it was my way of dealing with it ever after because I put it behind me.
We're speaking to Eugene Carroll, an advice columnist for Elle, author of What Do We Need Men For? A Modest Proposal, and Chavisa Woods, author of 100 Times, A Memoir of Sexism. Before we get to Chavisa's story, I'd like to play a clip of the president who has vehemently denied these allegations in Ms. Carroll's story. Here's part of what the president said.
It's a totally false accusation. I have absolutely no idea who she is. There's some picture where we're shaking hands. It looks like at some kind of event. I have my coat on. I have my wife standing next to me. And I didn't know her husband, but he was a newscaster. But I have no idea who she is.
That was President Trump responding to the allegations that he assaulted Ms. Carroll. He also said in an interview with The Hill magazine that Ms. Carroll is, quote, not my type, unquote. Eugene, what did you make of the president's comments?
I didn't listen to him. And by the way, Chavisa, who's sitting opposite me, put the president on mute when you played that. People do not have a good reaction to him denying the 23rd woman who came forward.
Now, he said he didn't know her husband. Were you married at the time?
No, I was divorced, but he knew my husband because he was an anchorman on TV in New York.
Okay. What made you decide to finally tell your story?
Because I write an advice column, and ever since the Harvey Weinstein bombshell hit, Megan Toohey and Jody Kantner just blew that, just completely exploded it. Well, the letters I started receiving at the Column, women started asking me, should I report my boss? Should I call the police when my husband beats my dog? You know, and I'm thinking, I am so full of malarkey because I have never told these women really what's going on in my life. And I'm advising them to report things to the police. And, of course, I didn't do it myself. So I thought it was time. I just couldn't go on being, because it had happened to me and I'm advising them, I thought I should come clean.
Before we have to pause, anything else, E. Jean, that you wish you had done in retrospect?
Can't replay the past, Joshua. That is a fool's game.
Well, but you said you should have gone to the police. Is there anything else you should have done?
No, I didn't. At the time, I couldn't have gone to the police. Any woman who has been through this and is told she has to go report it somewhere, it is almost an impossible. This is why women don't report. The feeling of going into a station where once again you're put through, this is an old story, put through the questioning, and why did you do this, and why did you do that? Mm-hmm. And it turns out when I did come forward, a lot of people told me that how wrong I was, why I was wrong to go in the dressing room, I was wrong to talk to him, I was wrong to not report it, I was wrong not to report it earlier, I was wrong to report it too late.
Right, right.
So it was all my fault, which, by the way, I believe it was my fault. Never go in a dressing room.
Well, we
got
right
a number of stories that
them.
Are similar to yours. We got to pause for just a minute. We'll continue with E. Jean Carroll and Chavisa Woods in a second. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're speaking about the toll that sexual harassment and assault can take, especially when it happens repeatedly. With E. Jean Carroll, advice columnist for Elle magazine and author of What Do We Need Men For? A Modest Proposal. And Chavisa Woods, author of 100 Times, A Memoir of Sexism. We'd love to hear from you, especially if you've had to deal with just the frequency of being sexually assaulted or sexually harassed and what that did to you and how you've dealt with it. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, email 1A at WAMU.org. And we understand there may be some details of your story that you need to leave out. That's perfectly fine. Share as much as you feel comfortable sharing. 1A at WAMU.org. Before we get to some of the stories that you left in our inbox, E. Jean, just to close the loop on your story, I can imagine that a number of supporters of the president hear your story and say, see, just another attempt for the liberals to tear him down, and they always do it on the same grounds. There was the Access Hollywood tape. There's all these women who've come out of the woodwork. Now there's the Jeffrey Epstein thing, this billionaire who's accused of sex trafficking. You keep trying to tear down President Trump in the exact same way, and it's not going to work. What would you say to them?
I would say, what? You haven't read about his finances? You haven't read about all the revelations in the New York Times about how he actually had no money in 1995? No money, zero. And he reported, he talked the Forbes into listing him at $3.5 billion. This is, almost everything. He's been documented by most journalists across the board of telling, since he took office, 10,000 lies. So his supporters don't hear these stories. They are not hearing these stories because they live in their own worlds, just as we, just as liberals live in their own world.
Well,
and I'm sitting across from Chavisa. Let me tell you, I love her book. The chapter headings are numbers, Joshua, which is laying it out, and is called 100 times.
Yeah.
And I love it.
And I do want to talk about that book in just one second, but first I should acknowledge that a lot of you left stories for us about what you have dealt with. Some of them are really heartbreaking and were really hard to hear, but we think that they're worth sharing. Let's get to a quick mashup of some of the stories you left in our inbox.
I'd like to share a story about when I was raped in college. I was 18 years old, and for months I'd been telling my boyfriend that I was not ready to have sex. Then one night, I had too much to drink, and he raped me. It's taken me years to come to terms with the fact that I was indeed raped. For most of my young adult life, I blamed myself for drinking too much, but the reality is he took advantage of me, and he took what he wanted.
My name is Susie. I was date raped when I was 15 years old. I am now 67 and still have trouble talking about it without crying. It has impacted me my entire life. It takes power away when you're a young woman. It takes a lot of power away.
My name is Dia. I was assaulted from the age of 5 to 7 by my dentist, my military dentist in the Philippines. And I have never dealt with it, ever. I get more and more traumatized every time I hear stuff going on in the news. The Me Too movement, I couldn't get out of bed for 3 days. And it's just hard. People don't understand. You know, some people are able to deal with it. Some people are just not. That's all. And you just keep going. That's all. You just keep going.
Thank you, Brett and Susie and Tia, for sharing your stories with us. We know it was extremely hard to do. We welcome more of your stories and thoughts, 1A@WAMU.org. Chavisa Woods, you've been very patient. Let me come to you and talk to you about your book, 100 Times. What made you decide to write that book?
Well, I'm very grateful to the Me Too movement, and I think it's just brought an issue that's so important to so many women to the forefront. But I was watching it, and I was seeing that most of it centered around sexual assault and naming prominent famous men. And that's why the news was really paying attention, and the media was sort of, you know, taking this, and it was a snowball effect, and it, you know, got really big. But I started thinking, the men in my life who have assaulted me and who have discriminated, it's also about discrimination, harassment and attempted rape and rape, are not prominent famous men with a lot of power. They're just everyday, middle class, working class, normal men, and they still have a disparate level of power in society compared to women. And it's still, even when you're just talking about someone like the lighting tech who tried to rape me when I was 14, hard to get them out of their positions of really minor power. So I wanted to really move it away from just naming and persecuting famous men and start to focus it on what the cumulative impact is on women when this happens to us over and over again, when we face discrimination, sexual assault, and harassment in every sphere of society, constantly throughout our lives.
What about the book's title, 100 Times? Any significance to that particular number?
Yeah, I think 100 is a significant number in the collective consciousness. For me, I think that represents something that is profound. We talk about history in terms of centuries. 100 times to me is my attempt to illustrate that this has had a profound impact on my life. That it happened at least 100 times. I'm only 37 years old. So I wanted that to be very clear. But also 100 times I think is manageable to hold, so that the reader can hold the entire story in their mind when they're done reading the book.
Now, as I understand it, Chavisa, you really hesitated to write this book. This was not a memoir you wanted to pen.
No, I'm a fiction author, actually. This is my fourth book and first book of nonfiction, and probably my last book of nonfiction. It's really an activist endeavor. Usually I'm very stylized. I like sort of literary arts. This book is very bare bones. It's just what happened from the age of 5 to 37, literally in every sphere of society, around the world, in different settings, in rural areas, in cities. I hesitated to write it for years. I started writing it 10 years ago and stopped. And when the Me Too movement happened, I thought, you know what? Now is the time. I'm ready to write this book, and I'm going to do it.
Were there any patterns, Chavisa, in the men whose actions you document in this list, either in what they did or how they approached you or who they were?
As far as who they were, no. I have found that men of all races, classes, nationalities, religions, social backgrounds have been socialized to participate in sexist behavior from the time they are young, because from the time we are very young, we are taught that women are a subcategory of human, that we are a very different type of creature to men. And I think when you're put in that situation and you're given that level of power and privilege, you naturally will begin participating in it without even being totally aware that you're participating in it. It's the water we're swimming in.
Can you elaborate on that, Chivisa? I'm sure there's some guys out there who think, I don't view women that way at all, and I would never do something like that to a woman. When you say that that's the framework that we're brought up with, can you give me an example of that? That may be something that, men aren't even conscious of that we're receiving.
Well, sure. I remember in the fourth grade, the girls and boys were separated, and the girls were taught about our menstrual cycle, having our periods, and the boys, you know, we found out were taught about sexual arousal and desire in separate rooms and separate classes for the day. And I realize now, looking back on it, that when boys were going through puberty, they were taught, like, this is, your body is going to change, you're going to start having these sexual desires. And girls were taught, you can get pregnant now, you have to control your body. And it was nothing about our sexual desire ever said to us at, when we were young. And I'm 37 years old, so this was in the mid-90s, when I was in, or I guess the early 90s when I was in grade school. And I think that has a profound impact on men and women when women are told that you are just an object of sexual desire. Your sexual desire is not equal to men, is not as intense as men's. And from the time they're very young, boys are told there's nothing to be ashamed of with your sexual desire. But girls are made to feel very ashamed of their sexual desire. And I think this also translates into women being afraid to come forward about rape. Because if they're afraid to say yes, they're also afraid to tell people that when they said no, someone didn't listen, because it could mean that they were complicit in that. And if women are ashamed of having had sex or having sexual desire, or having flirted, and that could be implied, then they're ashamed to come forward.
Talk to me, Chivisa, about how this list came about. As I understand it, you started kind of documenting the incidents that you had been through, not with a book in mind, but just as a process that you had hoped would be kind of, I don't know if therapeutic is the right word.
I think now looking back on it, I think it is a mindfulness technique to sort of just write down what happened and make lists. When I was 27 years old, I was living in Brooklyn, and it was a very hot summer. And, you know, you dress a little more scantily when it's hot. And I was getting sexually harassed in my late 20s to the point that it was having an impact on my mental health. I mean, it was mostly from street harassment. And literally, when I would walk out of my apartment down the street to the subway, I would get harassed at least two times in that 15-minute walk. Sometimes I would be groped. Men would grab my arm. I had a couple men grab my breasts. And I was just sort of spinning out. And my friends saw me that I was talking about it all the time. I seemed very agitated and anxious. And some of my friends thought maybe I was overreacting. And some of them told me I had to find a way to deal with this. So I started just writing down at the end of the day any incidents of sexual harassment that had occurred that day. And I thought in a few weeks I'll be able to look back at it and see if it really is as constant as I'm feeling it is. And the last log that I did, a man masturbated at me, kind of on me in the park, and I had to run away. Then another man, after I ran away and went to a different part of the park with my date, another man tried to grab me. And then I went home, and on my way home, a man blocked my path to my apartment and asked me if I was looking to get pregnant tonight. And I wrote that down at the end of the day, and the next day I looked at it and I just stopped. I stopped taking a log, and I thought to myself, you know, I'm not overreacting. I'm reacting appropriately to the circumstances.
Before I bring Eugene back into the conversation, Chivisa, I'd like to get your reaction to a tweet from Doc, who wrote, "Most rapists don't recognize themselves as such. I've been assaulted in various types of situations. The latest attempted to assault me in my own house. There have been more than five incidents in my life." Chivisa, you explained that there are some men in your book who have done completely inappropriate things, but they don't see themselves as monsters, as complicit.
Right. And I was actually just speaking about this outside with a woman I know. I think there's a part in my book where a man tries to kiss me a couple of times and I say no and he tries to kiss me again. And I write in the book, if this is all that had happened, this wouldn't be going in the book. But after the second time I said no, he pushed me down, grabbed my ankle, and attempted to force himself on me. And I don't know why exactly, but in so many conversations I have with men, they talk about it like flirtation or coming on to someone is the thing that we are saying you can't do. That is not true. We are saying there is a line. And to most women, I think it's very clear where consent is breached. And for some reason, and I think it has to do with what I spoke about before, about men feeling like they have sexual desire and women are only the objects of sexual desire without their own sexual desire. Men don't see that line as clearly because they haven't been taught to see it.
And Chavisa, before I bring Eugene back in, you describe yourself as a queer woman. How has that affected your experiences with sexism and sexual harassment and how people react to your account of what happens to you?
Well, interestingly, I was asked in an interview a few days ago if I had a more negative reaction because I'm primarily, well, I only date women, to sexual harassment and assault. And I thought, well, what is the implication here that if I were more physically attracted to men, I would like being discriminated against, assaulted, or raped? That's pretty ridiculous. I think what it has done, though, is I notice when I'm out with my male friends, men do not sexually harass me, especially on the street, as often. But because when I'm out, I'm most often with a female partner, we are more likely to get sexually harassed together. So I don't have that barrier in place from by having a male partner. So I think it has possibly caused more sexual harassment when they don't recognize us as gay. And when they do, it causes a combination of homophobic and sexist harassment to occur.
Eugene Carroll, let me bring you back in. You, like Chavisa, used a list to describe your experiences. I wonder how you reflect on just the fact that it's a list. If there was a point at which you thought, holy crap, I have like pages and pages of people who did this to me. Like, how do you wrap your brain around that?
No. I only had one page. It was all fit on one page. I could name them right down.
Well, but of the stories, that's multiple pages of stories.
That was pages and pages.
Right.
But it slowly dawned on me. I was on a road trip going to towns named after women, getting out of the car and asking women, what do we need men for? So I am hearing these stories from women who are telling me why they don't need men. And it can't help, Joshua, but remind me of all the little assholes in my own life. So the list happened during this road trip. And when I got home, I made it official on one page. And Joshua, I was astounded because it started at 3 with a babysitter and just went on from there. And the memories came back. And it was, by the way, I'm sitting across from Chavisa.
Mm-hmm.
She has a femhawk, a mohawk. It's about 4 feet high. It's red. And putting this microphone on her ears has dented her femhawk.
You know what?
I am very concerned about this, Joshua.
As a man with a mohawk, I want to formally apologize.
Wait a minute. You have a mohawk too?
Well, you can't see it on the radio. We'll continue in just a minute with Eugene Carroll and Chavisa Woods. We also want to add another voice to our conversation from the organization Time's Up, and we want to share more of your stories. Before we pause, here's one more that landed in our inbox.
I was sexually assaulted by my doctor. I'm a senior citizen. Nobody would believe me. This has been a nightmare. I have PTSD. I'm scared to death every time I go to a doctor. He put in my medical records that I was coming on to him. This record follows me everywhere. They won't remove it. How unethical, how horrible and immoral this is to do this to me. I'm just sick.
It's a good, I can't imagine not being sick over this. We'll talk about the efforts to have more accountability when things like this happen in just a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with E. Jean Carroll and Chavisa Woods. Before we continue, let me repeat that number to the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Here it is one more time, 800-656-4673. We've also included some other links that you might find helpful. You'll find them online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. Let's add one more voice to our conversation. Joining us now is Fatima Goss Graves. She's the president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Fatima, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund is.
So we launched January 1st, 2018, and we are a place where people can come to get attorney information, representation, and also assistance from public relations firms to tell their stories. Since we launched, we've heard from about 5,000 people who come from 60 different sectors around the country, all have similar stories of experiencing harassment or violence at work or related retaliation and need support.
It sounds like from the way that Time's Up was described early on that this is kind of to assist women who have been through something like this but need help in that kind of rubber meeting road way with actually doing something about what was done to them.
There's no question. You know, after Me Too went viral, survivors were telling their stories, some digitally online and others just with family and with friends. And some of them wanted to take a next step. And what they're able to do by calling Time's Up Legal Defense Fund is get a free screening with an attorney, find out if they have a case. And sometimes people have gone forward with their cases. We have now also been able to fund and support over 100 cases. And it is one of those things because when we look at who is able to often bring cases, oftentimes low-wage workers have real difficulty finding someone to stand up for them. But now we're able to hear from restaurant workers and farm workers, domestic workers, and make sure that they have someone who's fighting for them too.
We got a lot of comments, Fatima, from people who dealt with retaliation or shame or kind of being ostracized after they spoke out about what happened to them. We got a voicemail from a woman who said she worked in one of Donald Trump's country clubs and was fired after she reported being harassed. Here is what Elle left in our inbox.
My name is Elle, and I worked in Virginia for one of the Trump National Country Clubs. They had installed 360-degree cameras. The manager viewed us from home on camera and even on his day off, and he would call and make lewd comments about what we were bending over to do and that he saw us leaving a room. What were we up to? And I reported it to HR in New York, and soon after, I was let go. The girl who replaced me had the same complaints, and she managed to get that manager fired. But I ended up having to sell my home over it because they fired me at the beginning of January.
Wow. Elle, thank you very much for sharing that story. And she, unfortunately, is not alone. According to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, sexual harassment complaints rose almost 14% last year. Three quarters of those complaints included charges of retaliation. Fatima, how much of speaking out just involves dealing with retaliation?
I have to tell you that Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's numbers track the numbers we see at Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. So many of the people we hear from talk about how they tried to go to HR, they tried to use their formal systems, and when they did, sometimes they were fired. But retaliation takes many forms. Sometimes it means that you didn't get that promotion. Sometimes it means that you have to work that worse shift or you don't get enough hours. And so one of the things that we have learned is that it is not enough to deal with squarely the problem of harassment. We have to deal with retaliation. We really have to deal with the culture that allowed it to thrive in the first place.
Isn't retaliation illegal, though? Is there any law preventing that?
It is illegal, right? It is illegal, but what they are counting on is that you're not going to do anything about it. They're counting on the fact that when they retaliate against you, they send a signal not just to you, but to every other person in that workplace who dare speak up. And that is what has been so powerful about Me Too. The opportunity for people to fight back, the opportunity for people to change that calculus. It is now worse for employers to do nothing, or worse for employers to retaliate against that brave person who came forward and tried to make a difference.
So what do you do, Fatima, for women who have the least power in our society to defend themselves when losing their job, or, you know, say they're undocumented workers, so deportation is a potential threat, when losing their job could basically shatter everything? How do you give them the strength to go on?
I will tell you, not everyone decides to come forward. But one of the things that we know is that there is power in the collective. That's why we saw Me Too go viral, right? People found each other. So sometimes people aren't ready to go for it by themselves. But when they're paired up with other people, when they find the way to come forward as a group, that changes the calculus. We also know that our laws are failing many workers. They're failing them because they're not always covered. Too many workers are in workplaces that are small, or in workplaces where they are technically considered independent contractors, so therefore not covered by our federal civil rights laws. So we have to change that too.
And just to be clear, Fatima, why does working in a small workplace make a difference?
Well, our federal laws start with employers who are 15 or more. So if you're working in a small restaurant or a small store, or if you're a domestic worker working in a home, in almost every state in this country, you have no federal protections. Those are the types of changes that we need to make.
We're speaking to Fatima Goss-Graves, the president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Also, Chavisa Woods, author of 100 Times, a Memoir of Sexism, and E. Jean Carroll, author of What Do We Need Men For? A Modest Proposal. Fatima, you mentioned the Me Too movement. How have you watched this movement evolve just since the Harvey Weinstein story broke?
The Me Too movement has exploded. And one of the things that I wanted to correct is, it has not been and has never been just about high-profile people. It is true that the media was very enamored with high-profile people. But what has been beautiful about the vision of Me Too that Tarana Burke outlined is that it allowed people to be connected, whether they are working under the bright lights of Hollywood or in the shadows of janitorial work. And that work has continued. It also has allowed people to tell stories outside of work, the harassment and violence that students experience, the harassment and violence people experience when they're trying to get medical care, when they're trying to get housing. So what Me Too movement is really doing right now, it is changing our cultural understanding of what is and is not okay behavior. And that cultural shift will be very difficult to undo.
Chavisa Woods, I understand that you are a supporter of Me Too, but you've noted that there are gaps in the movement that you hope your book would help fill. What kinds of gaps are you talking about?
Well, I suppose that sexual harassment and sexual violence are only one part of a much larger systemic problem. There are disparities that just have no equivalent in the lives of men. Male violence is actually a major health risk and a factor in mortality rates for women. And there's no such thing as like a reversal of that. Women are not murdering men because of their gender and because of the sexist disparity at rates anywhere comparable to the rate that women are actually murdered by men and often by their male partners when they're trying to leave the relationship. There are disparities in the amount of money that we're paid. There are disparities just in the way that we're treated by our families in every sphere of society. So it's not just about sexual violence. It's also about discrimination, unconscious bias, and violence.
Eugene, I'd love to get your sense of the changing way that we're talking about sexual assault, rape, sexual harassment. We heard from several of us, from several listeners about what happened to them. And I'd love to get your reaction to another mashup. Here is what three more listeners left in our inbox.
My name is Melanie and I'm calling from Michigan. I was sexually assaulted 17 years ago by the uncle of one of my friends. What's unfortunate is how vulnerable I still feel sometimes, even all these years later. The pain I feel is just as strong as it was all those years ago.
Hello, my name is Maureen. I was raped when I was 11, and it was at that time that I realized the limitations of being female. No matter how much I fought, it wasn't possible for the inevitable to happen. That definitely was a huge life lesson at such a young age.
Hi, this is Diana from Michigan. When I was a junior in high school, I attended a party where I was date raped and it was videotaped. It was then distributed throughout my high school and at parties for weeks after. My parents went to the police and the police decided that because I was drinking alcohol, I was to blame for my rape and assault. It took me 10 years, several mental health facilities, an attempt on my own life in order to cope with it.
I was raped by my boyfriend in my mid-20s, someone I loved, and I didn't report it. In fact, I tried to just forget about it. And I also believe that, you know, maybe it didn't happen. It wasn't rape. Couldn't have happened to me.
Thank you, Melanie and Maureen and Diana, for sharing your stories with us. Eugene, that last caller mentioned that she thought maybe what happened to her didn't happen. It wasn't rape. You have said that you don't think of what happened to you as rape, though legally it may be considered so. What's your sense of the kind of changing way that we're describing these same kinds of incidents?
Well, every woman gets to choose her own word. Every woman, my word is fight. Other women, you know, they like the word harassment or rape. I just want to say that these stories that you've been playing today are so powerful and so moving. I think that as Fatima said, and as Chavisa said, if we band together, if we gird our loins, if we bare our talents and go a little bit beyond just telling our stories, I think we can actually change the culture of sexual violence. I can see it when I heard those voices and I'm sitting across from Chavisa. I think we can pull this off if we continue to tell our stories, but just not say the story, but be ready for the battle. Be ready for the battle. It's not easy. And Chavisa and I are behind these women 100%.
As are we all. As are we all, for sure. I know our time is short. Let me get to one more question for all three of you that I'd love to ask. Well, actually, first of all, Fatima, before I get to that last question, if women have a story to share and they need help, how do they get in touch with Time's Up? Like, what kinds of cases are most squarely inside of what Time's Up focuses on, and how do they reach you?
So Time's Up Legal Defense Fund focuses on workplace harassment and related retaliation. So if you have an experience that falls in that category, or if you think it might, you should contact us. And you can find it on our website, nwlc.org/legalhelp. You could also just Google Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Very easy to find.
I wonder if, by way of wrapping up, you know, I hate the fact that Eugene and Chavisa, that you've been able to even write a list of all these men who did these awful things to you. Before we go, is there anything that you wish all the men who are listening now knew, or something that we would all do to help change things, to prevent other women from having a list to write? Eugene, briefly, what would you want us to do?
I want to collect every man in America and put them all in Montana and retrain them. That's what I want to do.
And what would class one on the curriculum be?
Oh,
like, what's
kindness.
The main thing that you want?
Kindness. Kindness for their fellow humans. That's, if they could see women as their fellow humans and treat us kindly, we'd go very far.
Chavisa, what about you?
I feel like for decades, women have been saying the way that sexism the way that we experience sexism is intolerable and unacceptable, and the collective pushback from men has just been to say, no, it's not. It's not that bad. And the Me Too movement and Jean and I and are sitting here saying, yes, it is, and it's time that you listen to our stories and you try to have empathy and understand the toll that this has taken on us. And I don't think we can do it. I don't think we can do it without men taking the time to try to understand that we are inherently not so different from them and that we deserve to be treated with total equality.
And Fatima, very briefly, what would you say?
I'd love for men to take the time to tell their own stories, including the stories of how they've changed, including the stories of how now that Me Too has gone viral, they see how their past conduct was totally unacceptable then and what they plan to do different going forward.
Well, we appreciate all of you sharing your stories. And for the men listening who still don't believe, you've heard it. And now if you don't disbelieve, it's by choice. And there's nothing very manly about that. Fatima Goss-Graves is the president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Chavisa Woods, her new book is called 100 Times, A Memoir of Sexism. And E. Jean Carroll, author of What Do We Need Men For? A Modest Proposal. Today's conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.